I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to focus on the upcoming mayoral election. Next Tuesday, Indianapolis will elect a new mayor. Today, we will talk with the Democratic candidate for mayor, Joe Hogsett. On Tuesday, we talked with his Republican opponent, Chuck Brewer. We'll talk about Hogsett's agenda for the city, should he be elected. Please join this important conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Our email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're continuing our ongoing conversation about Indianapolis's upcoming mayoral election. On Tuesday, we had Republican Chuck Brewer in here in the studio to talk. Today, we are going to be talking with Democrat Joe Hogsett, and then next Tuesday, while the election is going on, we're going to be talking with the four former mayors of Indianapolis, Richard Lugar, William Hudnut, Stephen Goldsmith, and Bart Peterson, about what it means to step into that job. I'd like to welcome our guest, Joe Hogsett, to the studio. Second time here for us. Good to have you here.
Glad to be back at No Limits, John.
Good. And I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation. They can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, one of the questions, and I'm trying to frame this since we've got both of you, to ask many of the same questions, and the ones that are sort of specific are to your proposals. One of the things I asked Chuck Brewer when he was in here on Tuesday, you know, campaign is an arduous thing, and it is a life-shaping kind of experience. So I'd like to ask, you know, you've been a declared candidate now for just under a year, and you've been pretty actively talking to people. What have you learned from the experience of running for mayor of Indianapolis? I mean, what is the thing that has the most profound effect on you?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think I would answer it, John, by saying the most profound single thing I have learned in the last 15 months is how little I knew about Indianapolis, even though I've lived here 35 mm-hmm. years. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we all kind of those of us who have lived here for a long time, we feel like we know Indianapolis. We feel like we understand, and certainly somebody like me who served for 4 years as our federal prosecutor, I saw a lot of bad neighborhoods in our mm-hmm. community, as well as enjoy over the course of 35 years the good neighborhoods. But it has been an enormous learning experience, because you really see up close and personal the challenges facing so many of our communities throughout this great city. You see all of the shiny bricks and mortar, but you also see the bad aspects and the elements of our community. And it has been a profoundly important learning experience. I think that the truth is that type of education has made me a better candidate. I hope it will make me a better mayor if I'm elected. And I also have no doubt, John, that every day I serve as mayor, if the people of Indianapolis choose me to do that, I will continue to learn more and more and more about our city. So, yeah, I mean, I think learning more about Indianapolis and how little I knew when the campaign began.
Out of the experience, what has bubbled up for you as, you know, as people talk to you, what do they say are their primary concerns or their primary hopes, or, you know, what is the most important consideration for them right now?
They want to live in peace. I think they want to live in harmony with one another as neighbors. And that is why public safety and crime on almost any conversation that you have is the first issue that is talked about. I think that there is a general concern by people living in Indianapolis that that Indianapolis has become something that it really has never been before, and that is a place where people live in many instances in fear. They fear for themselves. They fear for their children. They fear for their grandchildren. And that is the issue that is discussed more often than not. Now, crime also tends to be a cyclical issue. If there is a period, maybe a month or two, of relative peace, then, you know, the issue diminishes in its importance. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, as we gather today, as you and I talk to your listening audience, this has been a rough couple of weeks for Indianapolis. I mean, four robberies on the east side of restaurant bars, the north side robbery at Kessler and College just last week, two individuals apparently assaulted in broad daylight at 86th and the Monon Trail. Those types of items cause people to be very, very concerned. And what they understand is that no area of Indianapolis is immune. Mm-hmm. No area of Indianapolis can truly say we are at all times a safe neighborhood or a safe community. Obviously, there are challenged neighborhoods where crime is more frequent. But, mm-hmm. you know, when two men are assaulted jogging down or walking down the Monon at 86th Street at 12:30, you know, in broad daylight, that unnerves a lot of people.
We've gotten actually a couple of tweets on that subject, and I know you have a press conference media availability after this show where you're going to be talking about public safety issues, so we may preview a little bit of that. But we got a tweet from a listener named Spencer, followed on very closely by another one from a listener named Jason, says, please ask Joe Ogsett how he expects to decrease gun incidents like the one at Washington Square Mall this week. And he said, and I would follow up and ask how any decrease in gun violence can be achieved without reducing the number of guns on the streets.
Well, I think to both Spencer and to Jason, during my time as federal prosecutor, we went in the U.S. Attorney's Office from prosecuting one felony possession case, that's a gun or a firearm in the possession of a convicted felon, which is prohibited by law. Mm-hmm. We went on average from one prosecution per month to two prosecutions per week. The number of gun prosecutions.
So an 800% increase.
Exactly. And we went from one prosecutor prosecuting gun crime to 17. Okay. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, 17 prosecutors were not solely prosecuting gun crime. But I went to the staff of the U.S. Attorney's Office, all the assistant United States attorneys, and I said, would you be willing to add to your portfolio federal gun prosecution? And 17 people stepped forward, and so we had 17 prosecutors whose caseload involved gun prosecutions. Now, having said that, you cannot arrest or prosecute your way out of really any kind of violent activity, but particularly gun-related crime. And so that is why in my public safety plan, John, the 14 pages that it encompasses, probably the first six or seven of those pages, really have very little to do with law enforcement and have much more to do with investing in young people at stages of their lives where we are encouraging, to the extent possible, hope and opportunity for them, which I believe encourages good decision-making over and against bad decision-making, good choices over bad, so that we keep our young people out of the criminal justice system altogether, so that they are not tempted by the allure of quick and easy money in the drug trade, for example, and so that they see a pathway to accomplishment and achievement where prior thereto maybe they had no realistic notion that there was hope for them and their lives. All too often in the past, I think we have focused on what do we do to try to save our kids, or what do we do to try to save these young people who are engaged in no small measure in this gun-related violence. When I say young people, the recent stories were that kids as young as 10, 11, 12 years old were attempting to rob CVS and Walgreens pharmacies in our community. The truth is that when I say young people, I'm talking about anybody who is under the age of 25, because to me, those people are young.
Yeah.
And frankly, those are all too frequently the ages of people, 15 to 25, where people are resolving their differences through gun-related violence. Mm-hmm. And so I think investing in our young people so that they are not recruited by the gangs and so that they can stay away from bad decision making and bad choices. That is, and by the way, this challenge did not happen overnight, and so we will not fix it overnight. Mm-hmm. But if elected mayor, I will begin the process of addressing this issue on the very first day of my administration. And if we do not resolve these issues, I think our community will continue to be enormously challenged in so many different ways. Let me just add one last thing, John, because I, as you know, having served as federal prosecutor, I could talk about this for the entire hour today if you let me, and I know you won't. We also have to have discussions about the role that poverty plays in so many different areas. Crime is one. Educational attainment and achievement, or lack thereof, is another. Economic and workforce development is another. We have experienced in Marion County over the last decade or two an exponential rise in the level of poverty. You're seeing it now statistically. One in three children in Marion County today are born into poverty. You're seeing it in our school systems where, gosh, you name the school corporation, 60, 70% of the kids are eligible for free or reduced lunches. Mm-hmm. We need, and the next mayor is going to be required to lead our community in discussions about how we address these issues of poverty, because they are inextricably linked with crime and violence.
In terms of the investment strategy you talk about and giving young people in particular the alternatives, what does that look like? I mean, where would the resources be invested? What kind of alternatives are we creating for them?
I think that it begins at the earliest stages. I mean, pre-K is obviously a very, very important investment. I applaud Mayor Ballard and the City County Council for reaching an agreement. Obviously, I have to throw Lilly and Cummins and other private sector partners into that applause, because now 1,300 kids who probably would not have otherwise had pre-K available to them will. So it begins with an investment in pre-K. It continues with a quality K through 12 education, encouraging mentor relationships and mentor programs that are already in place, but they need to be expanded, and we need more of a volunteer commitment in that regard. It also involves, for example, the Summer Jobs Initiative that I proposed last summer, where 14, 15, 16, and 17-year-old at-risk youth can be given 6 weeks of meaningful employment during the summer to keep them off the streets and keep their minds productive and put a little money in their pocket.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with the Democratic candidate for mayor, Joe Hogsett. We talked with his Republican opponent on Tuesday. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. That's a toll-free call. You also can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. And you can do the old-fashioned, relatively old-fashioned way and reach out to us via email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Once again, we are talking with the Democratic candidate for mayor of Indianapolis, Joe Hogsett. This is No Limits. I am John Krall. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are continuing our conversation about the upcoming Indianapolis mayoral election. On Tuesday, we talked with Republican Chuck Brewer. Today, we are talking with the Democratic candidate for Mayor Joe Hogsett. And next Tuesday, we're going to be talking with the four former mayors, Richard Lugar, William Hudnut, Stephen Goldsmith, and Bart Peterson, about what it means to step into that job. If you would like to join the conversation, if you have questions for Joe Hogsett, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can do what a listener named Christopher did and find us on Twitter at WFYI. Christopher says, Joe, 4 months ago, I moved to North Butler Tarkington from the suburbs. What would you say to people like me already thinking about moving back to flee the high crime area?
Well, Christopher, it is unfortunate the amount of violence that the Butler Tarkington area has experienced over these last few weeks. It's not new to the area. In the sense that south of 38th, north of probably 30th, 32nd, east of Crown Hill, west of, you could probably go all the way over to Penn, Delaware. That has always been a very challenged area for gun-related activity, drugs. And what Christopher is talking about is now that violence has started to creep north of 38th Street into 40th and 42nd, and the neighborhood is understandably concerned. What I would say, Christopher, is one of the aspects, John, of my public safety proposal that I didn't talk about in our first segment, because we were talking about investments in our kids, investments in our neighborhoods, and how that they can profoundly impact, I think, our crime. But obviously, law enforcement does have an important component. One of my proposals is to add 150 additional police officers. Now, the reason why I think adding more police officers is important is not so much because an officer is going to be able to stand at every corner at Butler Tarkington and prevent any crime from happening, but rather 150 additional officers in the rank and file on the street will allow us to return IMPD back to a community-based, neighborhood-oriented beat jurisdiction approach to policing. Currently, IMPD is so understaffed that as a rank-and-file officer, I show up for my shift, I get in my car, and I cover a zone. And the zones are fairly large in many areas, which really means nothing more than I spend my entire shift responding to calls, driving from one end of my zone to the other, with no time to get out of the car, walk the streets. And ultimately, a community-based policing approach would allow neighborhoods to get to know their officers and officers to better know their neighborhoods. And I think that it will also allow not only time during the course of a shift for an officer to get out of his or her car, walk the neighborhood, talk to residents, talk to merchants, find out what's going on in the neighborhood, find out a little bit more about activity that may be taking place that needs to be monitored. But it also, I hope, will raise the community's level of trust in police officers and will allow IMPD to do more proactive type of policing rather than what I just said was nothing more than just simply reacting from one call to the next call to the next call to the next call. And so I think that that is an important aspect. Christopher has my commitment. As the federal prosecutor, I would also bring to the table, I think, not only a horizontal law enforcement strategy, which would obviously include IMPD and all other local law enforcement agencies to collaborate and cooperate in ways that perhaps they currently do not. But I would also, because of my background, be able to, I would hope, put together a vertical law enforcement strategy so that there is integration from federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies. The relationships that I enjoy with the FBI, the ATF, the DEA, the Secret Service, the U.S. Marshals, the state police, those types of relationships, I hope I would be able to leverage if elected mayor so that they can work in cooperation with local law enforcement agencies like IMPD and help eradicate the systemic, the chronic criminal activity that all too often permeates too many of our neighborhoods.
You mentioned before we went to the break that one of the mayor, whoever it is, the next mayor's tasks is really going to be talking about poverty and figuring out how we deal with it. And you're right, the numbers are fairly stark. I mean, there are studies that show that somewhere between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 children in the state of Indiana lives in poverty, and that, you know, that those numbers are actually worse in many urban areas. What accounts for that increase in levels of poverty, and what can we do about it?
Well, I think that it's a problem of enormous complexity, and you can't really identify one particular element. But clearly, I think over the last decade, what we have seen is a transformation in the economy of Indiana because of the so-called Great Recession of 2008. Mm-hmm. So the good news is, John, we have, and our governor reminds us, as he should, record low levels of unemployment. That's good. Mm-hmm. People are working. And at, as I said, record low levels, according to the governor. But what the untold story is, while they may be working, they're not making the same level of earning power or not attaining the same level of earning power that perhaps they did prior to the Great Recession when mm-hmm. they were displaced and unfortunately found themselves in unemployed or, as I would say today, underemployment. So they're working one job or and at an underemployed rate, or they're working two jobs to simply make up for where they were before 2008. So in many respects, it's that shifting economy that has caused people to experience higher levels of impoverishment than perhaps they did 10, 15, 20 years ago. Also, obviously, education and educational achievement, as statistically those levels have been challenged and in many areas declined, you're going to see a drop-off. Ultimately, also, providing a robust and good environment for job creation is a reason why we see increasing levels of poverty, because the types of jobs are not the quality that they once were. So it really is a very complex problem, but it's one that at its very root is in the earning capacity that people have over and against where they may have been 10, 15, 20 years ago.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Ann, and if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Ann says, I have the benefit of living in a neighborhood that currently has access to Indigo bus service, and I have used this service on Route 28 for 10 years to commute to work. This reduces traffic congestion, parking needs, and commuting stress. Over the last year, I attended many public meetings on the new plan for city transit, which has eliminated the loop of the route I have used for the last decade while proposing to expand to adjacent counties a constructed system of routes and stations. Indigo has been minimally funded and functioning in this city, yet now funding is sought to more efficiently serve other counties with more frequent service. Please explain how this is acceptable in a world-class city to cut existing routes citizens are currently using in favor of serving businesses out of county.
Well, my response to that would be we need an investment in mass transit. And to Ann, I would say help is on the way. And by that I mean, obviously, through the state's regional cities initiative, the city of Indianapolis has made an application that will, if successfully awarded to the city, help construct the Red Line. Now, that's Ann's point, that a Red Line is designed to help mass transportation from essentially Hamilton County, ultimately, through the very heart of Marion County to Johnson County. But you do need greater connectivity between Indianapolis and the contiguous counties. But what must go along with that is an investment in bus transportation, quality bus transportation to various parts of our city. Currently, and Ann's point is that it is pretty easy. I take the 18 with some frequency from my home at 82nd Street downtown. Mm-hmm. And it is, Indigo does a very good job of providing transportation for people from all four corners of Indianapolis to the downtown area and back home. Mm-hmm. What it does not do very well, and as mayor, I would pull together the leadership of Indigo to address these types of concerns that Ann has expressed. What it does not do very well currently is it does not get you from one side of the city to the other. It's impossible to get on a bus, or not impossible, but it just takes an enormous amount of time with a lot of switches to get from Irvington over to the southwest side of the city if you happen to work at Rolls Royce or, you know. And we must do a better job with that. The other thing I would say to Ann is when I say help is on the way, there will be a referendum a year from now on the ballot. And that referendum will ask the people of the city of Indianapolis just exactly what kind of mass transit do you want and what are you willing to pay for it? And I think that's precisely, John, I think that's precisely the way those types of big decisions need to be made. And that is with the people, every taxpaying resident of the community being able to weigh in on that question. How much mass transit do we want? What type of mass transit do the people largely support? And therefore, what are they willing to pay for it? That will be an important issue that will be, I'm sure, debated and discussed over the course of the next year. We'll have the results from the referendum in November of 2016. And if elected mayor, I would respond accordingly and make the kinds of investments that the people of Indianapolis have indicated through a referendum that they want to see the city engaged in.
Is it possible? I mean, just getting to the point of that referendum was a somewhat tortured process in terms of dealing with state government. And I hear complaints from many local officials from around the state that in many ways the state now ties the hands of local initiatives. as mayor of the presumably of the state's largest city, should you be elected on Tuesday, it's a different kind of environment to be mayor than it was 20 years ago. How do you deal with that? I mean, the guardrails are a lot closer now that you have to drive within.
Yeah, you're right. And I think the way you deal with it is the way I've tried to deal with every position of public responsibility that I've been given, whether it was in the Secretary of State's office or whether it was in the United States Attorney's office. The Department of Justice made one thing absolutely clear, that even though that you were appointed to that position by a political process, I mean, after all, you are a presidentially appointed official, that's where the politics ends. Mm-hmm. You check the politics at the door. And obviously, I'm running as a partisan for election to be mayor. But I'm not running to be the mayor of a political party. Mm-hmm. I'm running to be mayor of the city of Indianapolis and all of its citizens. So if elected, I hope that that spirit of, you know, some people call it bipartisanship. Others call it nonpartisanship. I would like to usher in an era of what I call postpartisanship, and that is that we don't look at ideas as we don't work with the city council, and we don't work with the members of the General Assembly and look at ideas as Democratic ideas or Republican ideas, or for that matter, Mayor Ballard ideas or Mayor Peterson ideas, but rather look at ideas just as good or bad ideas. I'd say in addition, John, that I want to be a very real presence in the hallways of the General Assembly, because one of the points that you made, and it's not of recent vintage, historically, the Indiana General Assembly has been completely averse to any kind of local fiscal home rule. Mm-hmm. They've just been very proprietary about it. That is why, if elected mayor, one of the very first things that I would try to do is reach out to leadership in the contiguous counties, the mayors, Mayor Brainerd, Mayor Fadness, Mayor Cook, Mayor Ditzler up in Hamilton County, Mayor Myers down in Greenwood, the town leadership out in Hendricks County and in Greenfield and Hancock County. And even though we may not be of the same political persuasion, right, just lay aside those differences and figure out what is in the long-term best interest of metropolitan Indianapolis, and go to the General Assembly united as one for a vision and for efforts designed to improve the quality of life for metropolitan Indianapolis. And call me Pollyanna, call me naive. I hope that I have the kind of understanding of our history. I hope I have the kind of personality. I hope I have the sense of energy and daring and commitment that will enable me to be very effective in breaking down the silos, bringing together in a collaborative way leadership, not just from mayoral leadership, but county councils, county commissioners, bringing along those types of leaders who can go to the elected members of the General Assembly and say, these things are important not just to the city of Indianapolis, but they're important to those of us in Fishers and Greenwood and Brownsburg and Mount Comfort. Those are the kinds of collaborative efforts and the kind of spirit that I would bring to the mayor's office with me.
We are talking with the Democratic candidate for mayor of Indianapolis, Joe Hogsett. On Tuesday, we talked with his Republican opponent, Chuck Brewer. This is part of an ongoing conversation about the upcoming mayoral race. Next Tuesday, we're going to be talking with the four living former mayors of Indianapolis, Richard Lugar, William Hudnut, Stephen Goldsmith, and Bart Peterson, in anticipation of next Tuesday's race. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today with the Democratic candidate for mayor, Joe Hogsett. On Tuesday, we talked with his Republican opponent, Chuck Brewer. Next Tuesday, we're going to be talking with the four living former mayors of Indianapolis. If you'd like to join this conversation and talk with candidate Hogsett, you can do so by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Mark has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi, Joe.
Hi, Mark.
Joe, you recently said that Bobby Kennedy was one of your greatest political influences.
Yes.
You know, he took a hands-on approach in forming public-private partnerships for the purpose of revitalizing the neighborhoods in New York City. Will you do the same as mayor of Indianapolis?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Mark.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. The answer is yes. I think that the neighborhood-based economic development and our general neighborhoods vision that is part of our campaign platform, which you can access on www.joehogsett.com, is, I think, very revealing in terms of what I believe neighborhoods can become and how important it is for residential, commercial, and retail redevelopment in many areas of our city that have been, over time, either overlooked or maybe even, dare I say, ignored. Many of our neighborhoods are doing well, and we ought to underscore that. That is, you can't go down to Fountain Square or up Mass Ave or in other parts of our city and not see wonderful evolution and development. But in too many areas, other areas of our city, those neighborhoods are in desperate need, and it will take a public-private partnership, which Indianapolis has always done very well. Government can't do really much alone, and as my friend Brian Payne at the Central Indiana Community Foundation likes to say, we need to be more engaged in the business of cross-sectoring, where you have investments from private business, from philanthropic and charitable not-for-profit organizations, from NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and from the government itself, working cooperatively and collaboratively together to help, for example, provide more affordable housing in many of our areas. That's important because with affordable housing comes people. And with people, density is created. And when you have density, then you have the possibility of a commercial and retail investment that, again, helps build neighborhoods. It's also important, and I'll just say this as a final matter, to get the education component right. If neighborhoods are not going to evolve the way all of us would like to see them evolve, if you don't have quality educational opportunities for our kids. So all of those things in cooperation with one another, I think, will be a priority of my administration should I be elected, and hopefully we'll see some success.
Gotten an email from a listener named Don, and again, if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Don says, I tend to agree with your assessment about a greater need for safety. One of the issues related to safety is the drug abuse epidemic in our city. It has been shown that greater access to drug recovery programs decreases city crime. What are your plans to address the lack of adequate drug recovery programs in Indianapolis?
Well, just this past July, I was able to appear along with my opponent, Mr. Brewer, before the Continuum of Care Coalition here in our city. And it is a group of individuals and organizations that obviously Don's question is about drug abuse or substance abuse, but This Continuum of Care Coalition really addresses not only how we provide greater access to wraparound social services for those who are victims of substance abuse or addiction, victims of mental illness, periods of temporary or maybe even chronic homelessness. And I think that what I would do as mayor is start to participate fully in the conversations that have begun by this Continuum of Care Coalition about how or assessing what is currently being provided, how effective that has been in providing services to those who find themselves victims of drug abuse or substance abuse, and then what we can collaboratively and cooperatively do to provide more services. I don't have those answers. I have the ability, though, hopefully, to enlist and surround myself with people who whose opinions I trust and respect, members of this coalition of care, continuum of care, who really know much more about what is needed. I would follow their leadership and try to be the kind of mayor who would be passionate about getting services to people who are in critical need.
We are talking with the Democratic candidate for mayor of Indianapolis, Joe Hogsett. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Bill, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. First, thanks to Mr. Hogsett for his willingness to serve. I have a question regarding the television and advertisements that his campaign is putting out, specifically regarding streetlights. It seems counterintuitive, but numerous studies have shown that more light doesn't necessarily mean less crime. And I'm sure there are places where lights are needed, but the additional lights bring more infrastructural needs. And the kind of light that we have right now, which is a hot white blue light, actually has negative effects on human behavior. I'll take my answer off the air, please. Thanks.
Thanks very much for the call, Bill, and the question. I should say that we've also got a similar email question from Tom, who says, the city through DPW pays the light bill to IPL for the existing streetlights. The number of lights are out and notably have been out at specifically crime-related locations. If IPL can't fix them, then perhaps the city should monitor or hire the contractors to fix them within a time frame equal to at least a minimum chuck hole repair rate. I guess we'll deal with it. I wanted to group those together so we deal with the streetlight questions all at once.
Well, Bill and Tom come at the same issue from a little bit different perspective. Mm-hmm. Let me take Bill's question first, and that is I would work very closely with neighborhood associations. I don't mean to suggest in the campaign commercial that I think a street light is needed on every corner. I mean, there are many areas of our city that either are already adequately served or there are areas of our city where people just simply don't want additional lighting. Well, the commercial is not meant to suggest, I don't care whether you want a light or not, you know, we're gonna put one in. I would work very closely with neighborhood associations. Now, it is also true, and I know that Bill understands this, that there are also many areas of our city where people will not go outside after the sun goes down because they are fearful of doing so. So while Bill makes the point that, you know, there isn't maybe a direct correlation between streetlights and a reduction in crime, there clearly is a value, I think, to lighting in those parts of our city where the neighborhoods are completely dark to enhance safety, to enhance the public's confidence. And frankly, I think it sends an important message to that neighborhood that the city cares about the quality of life there, particularly if they feel like they've been overlooked. So Bill's point is well taken. I'd work with neighborhood associations very closely. We would be very strategic in our selection of where streetlights need to go. And then as it relates to Tom's question, he's right that we pay a light bill to IPL. Now, I'm not sure I would want to have lights fixed in what I believe Tom called pothole fixing time, because frankly, we've had a little problem fixing potholes. So I would reach out to IPL. And frankly, my streetlights proposal is going to be in no small measure dependent on a very close working relationship with the Indianapolis Power and Light Company, because the costs of new streetlights are going to be afforded by the change in technology from the hot white that currently serves our community to the LED technology, which I'm told by those who study these things provide 50%, 60% greater efficiency. They are cleaner. The light is more directed, so there's not as much quote-unquote light pollution. And it's those cost savings that, frankly, will enable us to lift the moratorium on streetlights, invest those cost savings in those areas that are currently not being served, and in so doing, hopefully do so in a timely way. I know the folks at IPL. I've worked with them in the past, and I hope if elected mayor, that type of working relationship could even be further enhanced.
Got an email from a listener named Steve who says, would your guest care to comment on the upcoming auction of seized firearms by Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, City of Indianapolis, and Marion County?
In complete honesty, I'm not aware of any auction taking place. But if there is an auction taking place, I'm not sure that seized firearms I would need to talk to the leadership of IMPD to find out exactly what the nature of the auction would be. I'm not aware of it.
We've also gotten an email from a listener named Eugene who says, how much of this upsurge in crime in Indy is organized?
A lot of it, and becoming more so with each passing day. As the federal prosecutor, and Eugene should know that I wasn't necessarily charged with the responsibility of day-to-day or prosecution of day-to-day street crime. In fact, what we did at the federal level was play, I think, a very important role in dismantling drug trafficking organizations and organized crime generally. Whether it was the Mexican cartels, whether it's the Outlaws motorcycle gang, federal law enforcement and federal prosecution is best left to the larger, more complicated issues. But to Eugene's point, and that is Indianapolis has seen an increase in the amount of organized crime, not only in terms of drugs and their importation to Indianapolis for distribution, but also just in the violence of the criminal element and the organization of the criminal elements themselves. That is why, and to reiterate a point I made earlier in the broadcast, John, I think that my background in this race is uniquely well-suited for the challenges that this community faces because of the relationships that I would be able to leverage with federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies so that we can more effectively invest time, energy, and effort in dismantling these more sophisticated, well-financed criminal organizations that are coming into Indianapolis, establishing a beachhead, and setting up their shop and running it, where 20 years ago they were in Chicago. Today they're here. Tomorrow, who knows where they will head. And that is why I'm hoping to implement this vertical law enforcement strategy as well as a horizontal one.
You've mentioned, you know, that your background and your experience position you well to deal with the challenges of the city right now. One of the, you know, the complaints that members in the opposition party, the things they like to say about you is that you're a career politician, you know, all of that sort of stuff. But the reality is you haven't held elective office now for more than 20 years.
Right.
And you were a very young man when you did that. I'd like to ask, you know, should you be elected again, what have you learned along the way? How would you approach the work of being an elected official differently than you did when you were Secretary of State?
Well, John, thank you for asking, because it gives me an opportunity to speak to perhaps the most frequent criticism offered by my friends on the other side of the political aisle. The truth is, I have spent a total of 35 years in the city of Indianapolis working professionally. Only 10 of those years have been spent in public life. I served as Secretary of State 30 years ago for 6 years. And then most recently, I served 4 years as the United States Attorney, the federal prosecutor. That leaves 25 years that I've been a member, hopefully a productive member of the private sector. And you are also right, John, in the fact that I've not held elected public office since 1994. Now, arithmetic may not be my strong suit, but that tells me I haven't been in elected office in over 20 years. So to those who like to focus on those things, I appreciate the opportunity to kind of clear up any kind of misunderstandings that the public might have. As it relates to your question directly, how have I changed? I think in two fundamental ways. There's no question that back in those days, I was single. I was young, and I was ambitious, and I'll plead guilty to that. But in the ensuing 25 years, I've become a father, a husband and father, and I think that changes one's outlook and perspective. And I've also had the opportunity now to serve as the chief federal law enforcement official for the southern two-thirds of Indiana, and that experience is invaluable.
And that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank our guest, Joe Hogsett, and I will say, as I did with Mr. Brewer, we wish you the best, good luck, and we hope that you will come back, win or lose, after next Tuesday and talk with us again.
Thank you, John.
As to our listeners, thank you very much for joining us. I'm John Kroll. Thanks for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.